And tonight we have Paul O, sober 18 and a half years now, active member in the 7:30 NABA early morning study group. Heard him share on a number of occasions. Last Monday, I can't tell you what he said, but boy, I said, that is exactly the way I feel. So tonight, let's hear more of that from you, Paul.
I'm Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. I can't remember what I said either, but I'm sure it was profound. It's a real honor to be here to be asked to do this. And I told Tim on the phone today when I talked to him, I congratulated him for how organized this is without being too tightly wound. I mean, this is just the email he sent, kind of gently. It wasn't even a reminder, an admonition. It let me know that I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope. It helps me. It helps keep me honest. It helps me open up and know and claim who I truly am. And hopefully, you know, one of you or several of you will hear something tonight that you'll identify with that will help you in your sobriety. I like that thing. That passage that says our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we were like today. And if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Now, I'm not going to sit up here tonight and tell, you know, say magical things where you'll be on fire and go running out and, you know, finish that fourth step and call your sponsor up and knock on his door and go do your fifth step or finish your eighth step or ninth step or all that stuff. But I can share my experience of some how-tos and some how-not-tos. Some of the how-not-tos I sort of now more affectionately refer to as me working the as a member of the I Can Handle It group of Paul's Anonymous, where I go off by myself and work the program by myself and then come back and issue position papers about how well things are going. The funny thing is that when I've done that, things don't go so well because I've sort of de facto become my own higher power again. So my goal is to tell my own story. My wife Deborah, who I love very much, is here not to make this a vanilla abridged version, because I'm pretty honest about all of it, but she helps me to tell the truth. You know, she learns a new thing every time, but she helps me keep it between the ditches. So, I used to think the truth was a basic starting point that you then embroidered on and made a better story out of, so I'll try not to do that. And I'm not going to try and convince or exhort anybody to do anything. The third step prayer, one of the most powerful parts of it to me, when I came here, like a lot of us, I just wanted to stop killing myself by my own hand and stop hurting so bad. I wasn't looking for a spiritual experience, though I'd been exposed to AA while I was still drinking, and I'll talk about that a little bit later in my story because that's a significant part of it. But I just didn't want to. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't think of another idea. I couldn't take another action. I gave up, and by grace, I was still alive, but I was not looking for a spiritual experience. But the third step prayer says, kind of gently or subtly, to me subtly, probably because I wasn't really looking or listening that well at first, tells me that my difficulties are taken away not only for my own ease and comfort. I'm supposed to be a demonstration, like we all are for each other, that this thing works. So people who are wondering at first whether, do I have it? Will this work? Is this truly the last house on the block for me? Am I just a good guy who just drank a little bit too much and caught a couple of bad breaks? You know, what's the deal? We hear somebody tell some portion of our story for us. And I've had it happen to me, and I've seen other people in meetings where you all of a sudden, you kind of know, you see them twitch and it's not a seizure or anything like that. A light bulb just went on. They're just like, holy crap, I did that, I thought that, and that's what happened to me. And if you did that and then tried this other thing and it worked for you, maybe that will work for me too. And that's how our program works, is one alcoholic sharing with another one. So the part of the third step prayer too that says that victory over those difficulties may bear witness to those that would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. That sounded like pretty lofty, unattainable, almost irrelevant stuff to me when I was so gauzy and out there. I just wanted to be able to hold a cup of coffee in two hands and get some of it in my mouth. I mean, that's kind of how it was for me. But those things have come true. Those things and continue to come true. It's not a done deal. It's not a all-over process. And I also have to say, this is the official... nothing's official in AA. This is the traditional gratitude meeting season, which starts now. It starts before Thanksgiving, just like Christmas carols and shopping and stuff like that. We get into gratitude meetings probably in October now. But I really am grateful for all the lessons and challenges and the things I tried that didn't work as much as the ones that have worked in recovery. And I couldn't say that when I first got here either. So I think you'll hear some. Hopefully, you'll hear some gratitude, because if I'm telling the truth, you'll have to hear it, because I feel a lot of it. You know, my story, there's this thing that we have the phrase reverse pride is one phrase that's used, where, you know, you get here and instead of trying to act like you got it all going on anymore, you get in here and all of a sudden you're the most worthless puke of a drunk that ever, you know, that ever suffered on this planet, and, you know, whatever anybody did, oh yeah, you had 3, well, I did 10, well, let me, you know, all that stuff. In a way, my story is just a typical story, but it's my story. And really, you know, I thought I was unique, and that was not always good. I may have acted like I was okay on the outside, because it was a matter of life and death for me, for you to not know how scared I was, how confused I was, how out of it I felt all the time. You know, that we have 50 different ways of saying an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You know, or another one is, I thought you all got the script or the directions and I didn't, or judging my insides by your outsides. And it turns out it's a fairly human thing. It's not just an alcoholic or addictive thing. To people ask you how you're doing, fine, that's your automatic response. If you're obviously coming apart at the seams, you might say, well, I'm doing okay, you know, which translate that to, I'm dying in here. But I would never do that. I could not be that honest. I couldn't be honest with anybody about anything. And so really the first segment of my life, my unique life, turned out to be, you know, a classic progression of alcoholism, which for me, I believe, started before I met up with alcohol. Because for a while, I'm one of those people that for a while, alcohol was my solution. And for a while, it worked in some ways. And then it worked less, and then it didn't work at all, and it brought a whole new raft of deadly problems all of its own. But the first one I can kind of call pre-alcohol, not alcoholic, pre-alcohol agnosticism. What I mean by that is something happened to me when I was, I think, 6 or 7 years old. I lived kind of an idyllic life for a little boy out on the far north shore of Long Island back in the early 50s, when it was pretty much potato farms and Indian reservations. It wasn't built up. I had good friends that we rode bikes with right near the beach. I had a black lab who went to the beach with me. We played cowboys and Indians and threw dirt bombs at each other and went to the beach and swam with our dogs. And my dad was a teacher, and he wasn't, you know, teachers back then really didn't make money. A lot of people who are teaching now probably should make more money, but back then, particularly in small towns like that was. So he got an opportunity to move to one of the suburbs of New York up in Westchester County. Now, we weren't going to get rich, mind you, but for him it was a big deal and a big advancement. Well, I found out later when he came home and told my mom, she was really unhappy about it. She didn't want to do it, and she really gave him a hard time. So when he came to break the news to me, you know, son, I have great news. We're moving to this place called Scarsdale, New York. I cried, and I probably threw a tantrum. I don't remember I did anything terrible, but I did what little kids do when they hear news like that. And one of the two times in my life, my dad, he didn't, you know, it was, we're not talking about a defax level beating, but he lost his temper, and he really wailed on me pretty good for a little while. it wasn't the physical pain. And I've really, this has really come to me. This is about my earliest memory, except for a couple of random emergency room visits and stuff like that when I was 3 and 4. I really remember that moment that I made a choice. And I made the choice of, I'd been reading a picture book of various fables, Roman and Greek fables, and there was this one picture that stuck in my mind of something, this guy, you know, tied down to the ground with a fox eating his vitals, eating his liver and his organs, and he was smiling, and he was a stoic. And I decided, I'm going to be a stoic. I'm not going to have feelings. I'm not going to feel anything. I'm not going to tell anybody what I feel. And this is not my dad's fault here. This is, I'm a sensitive little kid who's reading books and taking them and just ad hoc putting them into my life when something comes up. I don't want to make too much significance out of that, but really that formed me for the rest of my life, because really, until I got in here, and actually for quite a while after I got in here, you know, I was the guy who in treatment, the counselor took one look and listened to me and said, you're the angriest person we've ever seen in here. And I replied, forgive the language, but I replied something like, you stupid bitch, you tell that to everybody, shouting at the top of my lungs. And I did that a couple times. So one group, I dropped the F-bomb and the MF-bomb on her at the top of my lungs, and all of a sudden I could see myself and how enraged I was, and I started laughing. So I had all these feelings, but I denied even from myself I had all these feelings. So I was fine. I was just fine. Well, when I was about 7 years old, a year later, my dad was cutting the lawn. I think we had a push lawnmower, and he was doing it, and he asked me if I'd go in the house and get him a beer. And he liked it in a little Dixie cup. And so, for some odd reason, I poured some in the Dixie cup, and I poured some in me. I didn't like the taste. It made me burp. It was probably something cheap and atrocious. I don't know what it was. I wasn't into brands. But after the second one, with me burping and belching and not throwing up, I noticed a couple things. One was I could keep drinking that stuff, even though I didn't like it. And this warm feeling went right up to the top of my brain. If you think I'm remembering it like it was 2 minutes ago, I am, and just spread down over me. And I didn't know what it was, but I felt the sense of relief that the doctor's opinion describes in, you know, one sentence, one of the most important sentences in the book for me. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I like that effect. And did I turn into an alcoholic in that moment? I don't think so. I mean, I wasn't around. Nobody was around with a scorecard. One of my favorite guys in here, Gordon, I saw at the earlier 545 meeting. He's the guy who told me in recovery, don't keep score, because he heard me, you know, telling how I was doing this and how I was doing on that. So I'm not going back and saying, yes, at that moment I was an alcoholic. But I was so fertile for it. I liked it. I had access to it. My dad was the oldest of four children. His father died in the streets of Boston, in dire poverty from active alcoholism at like 50 or 51 years old. You know, you would think my dad might have said, I think I'll not ask my son to go in and pour me a beer. But it wasn't a problem at that point. But I made a mental note of that. Then came, you know, That's really the beginning of the period I describe as meeting and falling in love with alcohol. And it makes it sound like a relationship. And by God, it was a relationship. And it became pretty quickly the most important relationship in my life. And the one that defined all the other relationships, including romantic ones. If, when I was a teenager and starting to date, if you didn't have to drink like me or drug like me, because there are drugs in my story, and I'm very aware this is an AA meeting, I won't, you know, describe in detail how I smoked, you know, whatever I did with it, but a lot of drugs, which went away in the end. There was just alcohol. But you had to at least tolerate it. And what I tended to notice is I tended to find women who wanted to work on projects, and I was like a project. So I found women who, I hope many of them, if they need to be, are in Al-Anon now, because I think they all needed to be in Al-Anon. If they had anything to do with me, they certainly did. And it's not that I'm all that powerful, it's just, why would somebody, you know, what I heard a lot of was two things. One, I know what you need, and I'll be able to take care of that, and you're going to be fine. And soon, you know, anywhere from 3 months to 6 months into it would be, I don't know. There's this thing I keep running up against. We start to talk, and then it's like you shut down, or it's like some wall I run up, you know, against. And I would look at them like with genuine, what? Already thinking, okay, someone's going to be out of here. And you know, 95% of the time it was me. Once or twice I ran into a smart one who packed up and left before I did, but it was a sign the clock was ticking, because I kind of didn't know what they meant, but it also meant they were wanting to get close and move in and be closer, and I didn't believe back then intimacy had anything to do with honest sharing and stuff like that. I thought it was a physical thing, and maybe you commingled your bank accounts or something like that. That's what I thought intimacy was. The next phase of my life is really increasing use of alcohol and use of other drugs at the expense of emotional and spiritual growth. Isn't that a hell of a title for a segment of your life? I would call that late adolescence, teenage. And by the way, I'm not a circuit speaker, don't want to be a circuit speaker. If I were, or if I had a story in the big book, it would be called Living a Lie, because that's what I did my whole life. And I'm not proud of it. It just I constantly was living a lie. In the end, the lie was that you know, I'm not drinking when I was drinking around the clock. That's how dishonest I became, but I'll get to that in a moment. So anyway, I'm now in the increasing use phase, and things happened to me like in my teens. I was a classic underachiever. My dad had gotten a promotion into the administration of the school district I was a student in, which should have bothered me, but it really didn't, because I was already smoking a lot of dope and beginning to use some psychedelics and stuff like that. And you know, my dad once in a while would get a call. I started out in AP classes, which is advanced placement, and worked my way down the food chain into honors classes and then into regular classes. If I'd had a couple more years, I think I would have been in special ed and stuff like that. But, and I also, my lunchtime consisted of me and a couple of friends going on a far hillside, firing up a joint, drinking a beer, and waiting for the assistant dean to come out and begin to chase us around the grounds for the whole lunch hour, and then we would go back inside. And you know, I mean, that's how high school was. So I didn't have a whole lot of time for schoolwork and stuff like that. But I found another quality I had. I was no rebel. I mean, I did all this stuff, and my hair was really long, and I was in a rock and roll band, and it was great. I loved that stuff. It didn't really fill the hole in my soul, but it was something to do, and it was cool, and I actually liked the music. That wasn't pretend. But I began noticing that I had to keep 1 foot near safe ground. Other people were just total rebels. They were out there. I had to stay close enough, and like in my junior year, the dean brought me in. The one who used to chase me around got promoted to assistant dean. He didn't have to go out and walk around and chase people like me around at lunch anymore. And he said, you know, you're not going to go to college anywhere. And that was a big deal in the town I went to. Like 95% of the people went to college, and most of them went to Ivy League colleges, and we didn't have the money for that. But for some reason I wanted to go to college, mainly because it was like getting transferred to a lower level of prison, because high school really felt like a prison to me. I felt like a prisoner while I was in there, and while I was classically underachieving, and every 3 or 4 months having my dad say, you know, Mr. Maloney called me up and you owe a paper from September and it's March. And gee, I don't know what happened to it. I must have lost track of it somehow. So I did this flurry of work and I got my grades up enough that I was able to go to a college. Now, the college I went to was not the one my parents wanted me to go to. I went to a place called Bard College, which is on the Hudson River, about 90 miles north of New York. Steely Dan, if anybody remembers that band, they went to that college, and that song, I'm Never Going Back to My Old School, that's about Bard College. I made it a semester and a half and dropped out and hitchhiked across the country with my friend Zev. And then in Pennsylvania on the Turnpike, we found somebody we called, I don't know what her real name was, we called her Susie Good Vibes, because she was 15 years old, had dropped out of high school, was going to go out to Oakland, California and San Francisco and get into drama. This is 1970. So I'm a year late for the, you know, the summer of love ended like in 68. Haight-Ashbury turned to this mean-ass, you know, methamphetamine, horrible place. But we didn't know that yet. We were going out there just to have a good time. So we took her along with us. at this point, alcohol and drugs are really a central part of my existence. But I'm not telling anybody that, and I didn't tell my parents that I was going to drop out. They found out, several weeks later and all that stuff. But the safe part of me, when I did all that stuff, and I roamed around out there for about 6 months, and I made a little money, and one time I did the wire home for money thing, and, with the idea that I might be thinking of coming back home soon, like that was some great gift to them, I'll come back home and make you miserable from a closer distance. So eventually I ran out of steam and I want to come home and go back to college. And I did. I mean, they sent me plane fare and I came back and I worked my way in part-time into the school that they wanted me to go to the whole time, State University of New York at Binghamton. And I did, it was the same thing. I screwed around for years and finally the dean called me in there and said, you got to choose a major. You're halfway through your junior year, and if you don't choose a major, we're going to have to suspend you and kick you out of school. And I happened to be taking a course in geology, but it was the Rocks for Jocks course. It wasn't the high-level one. And so we did things like measure stream velocities while smoking joints and drinking beer. The stream's going 10 miles an hour, and write that down in the book. I love that course. So I became a geology major and did another one of my bursts of activity where I'd had no science or math, and I took enough science and math in a year and a half to get a BS instead of a BA. I don't know how I did that. And I got into grad school at the University of Wyoming. So now I'm going to go be a geologist. So I go out there to get my master's degree, and I worked hard and I played hard. And I would say that's where my drugs of choice at this point were really alcohol always. Wherever I went, there had to be alcohol. But speed and cocaine. And it took me a while in recovery to figure out I liked those drugs so well. A, I didn't want to go slow. The couple times I took stuff that slowed you down, I just could not see the point of it. If I want to get stupid, I'll just hit myself on the head with a stick or something like that. I wanted to go faster, but I also wanted to be able to stay up so I could drink for days on end because I loved drinking. I loved everything about it still at this point. A few little cracks were beginning to show up, and that occasionally I missed a deadline. I had a job as a graduate teaching assistant. One time I missed showing up to teach a bunch of, at that point it was an oil shortage, so a lot of oil was worth a lot of money, and a lot of people from the Middle East were sending their kids over to get geology degrees, and I was teaching a lot of them. And one time I didn't show up, and I made some excuses, and I lied. I was still living like, I was working so hard. But I also noticed I really wasn't loving what I was doing. But, who knew? I was just on this thing. And part of my thing was I had to succeed. I was a rebel, but I had to try and succeed while at the same time not wanting to succeed, at the same time living that bunker. By then it was a bunker, I didn't know at the time, of self-centered fear, peering out, knowing that even if I did succeed, and I had moments of success, I did really well on some tests and got some honors and stuff like that, but it meant nothing to me because I knew I couldn't maintain it, it wasn't going to last, the other shoe was going to drop. So I began doing these mini geographics, and I did it in relationships. Something would look like it was coming to an end, I'd move on. I never got to where I moved halfway around the world, though I fantasized about that, particularly near the end. I got an attack of 2 years before I got sober, I got an attack of telephonitis. I called up my sister in Maryland at 3 a.m. and told her I'd figured out the answer to my problems. I was going to take a bartending course in San Antonio, where I was unemployed, and then go to Australia and be a bartender. And she was curiously unmoved and unenthusiastic, just like Lois and Bill. Don't ever call me again. So I think at this point, if I'm a label maker, if I'm giving out team uniforms, I would have gotten the "you're an alcoholic, you're not a cucumber anymore, you're a pickle" T-shirt. But I didn't know that. I mean, I wasn't near the end of my story. I was in my mid-20s. I graduated got my master's from Wyoming, got a job with Shell Oil Company as a geologist, and it was still go, 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 and Houston was this exploding town and all this stuff. And I went down to be an oil and gas geologist. So I was locked in an office all day making these geologic maps, trying to periodically coming out to try and convince high muckety mucks to spend a few million dollars to drill a hole. Who knows? Maybe we'll find something. I was terrified of doing it. I was terrified of not doing it. I hated it. I was locked in by myself, and that's when I began really drinking in the daytime. There was across the street from my skyscraper, there was a little bar that I ended up calling the recovery room, and would talk to my peers about that. I'm going over to the recovery room, where I'd walk in and they would put out 2 egg rolls and 3 double vodkas, and they would give me more if I had time to stay, but that was my basic lunchtime meal. But I'd also, when I was at Wyoming, I'd taken the law boards, and I'd kind of always, you know, I watched too much Perry Mason when I was a little kid and always wanted to be a lawyer, so I went to law school at night down at the University of Houston and somehow did that. There was one exam, intellectual property law, copyrights and patent law like that, where I was so drunk during the final. In law school, you get one exam, it's called the final, that I was almost in a blackout. I almost couldn't hold my head up straight, let alone write on the paper, so I just kind of wrote for 3 hours, and I think I actually got a D on that exam, but somehow I got my law degree, and somehow I passed the bar. And so the day after I passed the bar, I was there, I was all by myself, Perry Mason Jr. with a tan, you know, this was state court, so he wore the tan suit and a ponytail, and picking my first jury, and inside I was dying, a million deaths. I was so terrified. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was on this thing. I was driven to try and succeed. Well, doesn't that make you just incredibly fertile ground for alcohol and drugs? I mean, that was the only way I could get through this stuff. And I had no belief at all that I actually knew anything. And I didn't know it at the time. This kind of insight has all come later through, you know, looking back through fourth and fifth steps and some prayer and meditation. Those are the things that, honestly, I never try and make excuses for myself, but really give me some compassion about myself as an alcoholic, because I was so clueless for so long. I didn't have any principles, any guidelines, any connection with anything outside of myself, though I would try sometimes. There's a line in the books that says, you know, we could have philosophical convictions galore, we could try all kinds of things. There was just nothing that could get through down into that bunker. And you know, several people have heard me say this. I'm sure I heard someone else say it's one of those 100 original ideas. I didn't make it up. But my core belief about myself, my whole life, from that moment when I said, I'm going to be a stoic, was I'm all alone and I'm not enough. Now, if that isn't a double bind set up for a life of terror, I don't know what is, because I'm not enough, but I'm all alone. So I have to somehow try and put it together and be enough, even though I know I'm not. Even though I know even the brief moments when I appear to be, I can't maintain them, and I'm gonna fail. I mean, it was even more at an existential level than that, not to get too heavy about it, but I didn't believe I really belonged here. I didn't really believe I was worthy of being here. But I was here, so I had to act like it was all okay. It's at this point that alcohol wasn't always working so well. And you know, by my descent, I'm half Swedish and half Irish English, and you know, I don't know what genetics mean, but there is something to them. I was born, and my sister was too, with not a hollow leg, 2 hollow legs and hollow everything else. I was born needing to drink a lot to get to the place I wanted to go to, and that just got more and more and more. Well, you reach a point where you know, you literally can't drink all you need to drink to be able to get there. So, you know, this part of my life I call living as a functional alcoholic, and I put that in big quotes because the functioning got less and less as long as I could go another step with it or think of another idea to somehow put off something another day. This is where people began talking to me a little. There was a time when I was a lawyer and I had 2, in Texas they call it DWI, driving while intoxicated. I had 2 cases where I was the lawyer representing people, and then when I met my San Antonio fiance on a drunken plane ride back from Washington, D.C. to Texas, and you know, we fell in love at first drink and first whatever. I was driving over a week later to see her on New Year's Eve, and I made it as far as Seguin, Texas, in Guadalupe County, where the county seat where I had those 2 cases, and I got popped by the same trooper who I used to try and cross-examine and make look foolish. And you know, somehow he didn't find the 2 ounces of pot I had in the back of the car, or else I might not be here. I'd be in the Texas, you know, writing blues songs at one of those Texas prisons or something like that. But the moment when I was there as a lawyer sitting next to one of my clients, and the judge said, "Well, Mr. Olander, are you here personally or professionally today?" And my client said, "What's he talking about?" I said, "Oh, it's okay. It's all good. We just have that kind of relationship. He's just kidding around, thinking to myself." That's how it was. It was that way a lot. So finally I did what any good alcoholic would do. You all know the answer to this one. "Paul, you can't drink and practice the law." So what did I give up? The law, of course. I gave all my cases away, and I became unofficially unemployable. I moved over in with my San Antonio fiance. It's really Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. We would both get toasted and scream and yell at each other and, you know, then do other stuff. And just this whole crazy cycle. And I actually put on my tan people suit one time and went down to the Bexar County DA's office. That's San Antonio. To apply for a job at the DA's office. I didn't know at the time that it's not enough to brush your teeth when you're drinking around the clock. Alcohol is coming out of your pores. And I convinced them how I had been a defense attorney on DWI, and I could certainly, usually the progression is you're prosecutor, then you go defense, but I brought all that up. They were polite. They didn't just kick me out of their office or arrest me for public intoxication, though they could have. I sort of didn't know why I didn't get that job. But anyway, stuff went on like that. And finally, my family, you know, had seen me at another vacation, and they called up and did a kind of telephone intervention. And it wasn't much of an intervention. It didn't have a lot of teeth, or there wasn't a lot they could do. They just said, my sister and father said, my mother was already, I think, coming down with dementia. I don't think she was in the nursing home yet. Maybe she was. Maybe she had just gone in there, so she wasn't part of the conversation. They said, "We can't stand to see you so unhappy, so please, please move back with Dad." So in the middle of the summer, I took a 3.5-day Greyhound bus ride from San Antonio, Texas, to the New York Port Authority. On halfway through the first day, the air conditioning broke down on the Greyhound bus, and so we drove, boy, Tennessee is a long-ass state when you're driving through, not drinking, going into full-blown DT withdrawal, because I was going to not drink as part of my coming home, as part of my graduation present. I'm sure I carried with me all I could. I'd sent some stuff home, guitars and stuff like that, and I'm sure my fiance had a bonfire in the backyard with the rest of my stuff when I left, because I didn't leave her without telling her, but I couldn't really tell her anything other than living a lie. Well, I just need to go get away and get it together, and I'm sure I'll come back once I get it together, thinking, "Oh, just get me the hell out of here." But I couldn't say, you know, I want to leave you. This isn't working. So my dad and his girlfriend met me on the hottest day of the summer in the New York Port Authority, and I was like, and he laid the big one on me. He said, he waited until the next day. He let me have a couple of beers. When we got home, he said, "Son, a condition of your living here is that I really want you to not drink. And I have a friend, a buddy of his who had also put his wife in the same nursing home, who had like 28 years in AA and the Hartsdale Ardsley group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Phil Wilson used to go to this thing. It was founded in 1940 when he wanted to get out of the city. He'd tool up there. And so for the next couple of years, my dad also got me a job pumping gas at a Shell station. I'd been a Shell oil and gas geologist. Now I was pumping gas. And I was glad. You know, I could handle this. I can do this. Unfortunately, the manager was a major screw-up, and he got fired a week later, and they said, "Well, you're a lawyer and you have business experience," so they made me the manager. And I actually, within a month or two, was making more money doing that under the table, of course, than I'd ever made as a lawyer. And so I started going to AA, to the Hartsdale Ardsley group, after working all day at the gas station, drinking all day at work and all night, because at this point I couldn't go any more than an hour without waking up in withdrawal and have to drink to get another hour's sleep. And the gas station job was so cool, because I had this brown Shell uniform, and, you know, I worked late, always at work, got to be at work, because that's the place where I had the best chance of drinking when I wanted to, and would pour oil and gas all over myself. myself to mask the. So I'm sure I was, and I smoked about three packs a day of cigarettes, so I'm sure I was great to be next to and smell. You know, once or twice they even led a third step meeting. They asked me, hey, will you be the discussion leader for the third step meeting? Yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, made a decision. We all got to make a decision. You want to share? You want to share? I kept resetting the clock, so, you know, my phony sobriety date, but 1 year it kind of got away from me because my drinking was progressing. I couldn't even keep up with my lies in AA. And so it was birthday time. So I had a 1 year anniversary at the Hartsdale Ardsley Group on a Saturday night. My sister flew up from Maryland. The lights went out. There's about probably 100 or 120 people. It's a big group, big coalesced group. And the lights went out, and she carried a cupcake with one candle lit up to the front. On the ride home, my father said, son, you didn't say much. And I said, well, I was just kind of speechless. That was one of the worst moments of my life because I got a brief glimpse before I could slam that window shut and go back in the bunker again of what a completely dishonest slave of alcohol I'd become. I did everything to get alcohol into me. So fast forwarding to the bottom, my dad decided to take a vacation. He pretty much went along with my lies, and you know, I think he knew at some level that I was probably lying, but I was his son, and he was my son, you know, kind of guy. And so he went away on a vacation. I was supposed to go back down to Texas and take some courses to keep my law license current. And I'd actually signed up, sent the money, had plane tickets. As soon as he left, all that went out the window, and I drove to every liquor store in Westchester County. I wouldn't go in and buy out the whole store. I bought 2 half-gallons at each store. This is like in March. There's nothing going on in March. Well, it was March Madness, but I wasn't really into that. And I made up something. I told the liquor store guys, yeah, I'm having a few guys over for a party. We're going to watch some football. It was like football. Was already over, and they're all like, "Oh no, you don't have to put the change in my hand because I couldn't hold my hand straight. Just throw it in the bag. That's all right." And I bought all the vodka in the world to me, and I locked myself in that house, and I drank around the clock for I think it was like 10 days or 2 weeks, something like that. And I didn't take the first step. The first step took me. I was in the same tracksuit I'd been in for 10 days to 2 weeks. I had TVs going all over the house. One memory I have is Robert Shuler. Don't ever bash Robert Shuler to me. He may be whatever he is. But that Sunday, he was doing a talk to alcoholics, and it was like his face came out of the TV, and he told me it was going to be all right. I didn't stop drinking at that moment, but he kept me from falling off the edge of the universe because I was holding on by half of the fingernail. And I couldn't get drunk anymore. I could not catch even a buzz or any numbness or anything. All I could get was my blood alcohol was so high that I was just totally intoxicated and probably on the verge of dying one of those alcohol deaths where you aspirate on your own vomit or your lungs stop or something or you seize out. And I just sat at the top of the stairs and I literally couldn't think of another idea. There was more vodka downstairs. I just said, I can't do this. And I don't know how not to do this, whether I said it out loud or not. Well, I was pointing out later, I'd just taken or been taken by both parts of the first step. And part of my deal in recovery has been never, ever to forget and lose that moment. There's a lot of things I can do, but my life is basically unmanageable by me as a sole manager. So, you know, the beginning of the end turned into the thing I most needed. I'd never been to Georgia before. I went to a detox up in White Plains, New York, where I'd actually gone in and led a few meetings while still drinking. And this time I was a patient, and I was in rough, rough, rough shape. I just was. I mean, my nerves were shattered. My tremors were coarse for about 6 months and moderate for another 6 months and all that stuff. But I really began to hear what was being said, and I really became as willing as only the dying could be, and they gave me a list of places to go to. They said, here's five. Number one is Decatur Hospital in Decatur, Georgia. Well, I'd never been to Georgia, Decatur, anything like that, so I said, okay. And they put me on a plane, and this was 1991, and, you know, I I don't have an opinion on this. I just have my own experience. Sometimes I have to struggle a little bit when I hear an old timer do some treatment bashing. Hey, my goddamn $20,000 big buck. It is what it is. I got so much. I'm not saying I couldn't have gotten sober without it, but I got, it was all about meetings, but it wasn't that old Clancy joke of, you know, a treatment center with only one van kind of thing. I mean, they took us to meetings because they knew that was part of it, but we did a lot of work there. That counselor telling me how angry I was and then listening to me exploded her. I was probably the most hated patient there because I was probably the most serious there, and everyone else seemed to be just kind of messing around. So that's where that and the halfway house I went to is where I got the nickname Captain Recovery, and it was not a compliment. And there's one person sitting in this room right now who I won't mention who actually called me that at a workplace, and I don't think it was a compliment there either. But they said get a home group. I got four until I was told you're only supposed to have one. AA can't keep good statistics if everybody signs up for multiple home groups. Get a sponsor. I had three, which I narrowed down to two, you know, a prime one and a backup one. Another one of my backup sponsors, Emeritus, is in this room tonight. The point is that I did it. I didn't do it perfectly. They said wear the program like a loose garment. I wore it more like a shrunken wetsuit, you know, with a suit of armor over it. I was grim. I was determined. But I was going to literature meetings. I was working the steps. A couple of things about the steps, wherever you are in the process of the steps. My first, fourth, and fifth step, they wanted to discharge me from treatment on a Friday. I guess, you know, the old saying, and I'm now in that line of work, so I better soft pedal this. It's possible that insurance was not going to pay for Saturday and Sunday because I was cured. But I, you know, sat in my room chain smoking Marlboros and said, you MF and MFs are not going to kick me out until I do my fifth step Sunday night, and they let me stay. And I did my fifth step, and 3 or 4 hours after I went into that room, we did it in a patient room, and I came out, and two hard-bitten weekend psych nurses said, and they're not the type to say anything nice or schmoozy, they said, you're different, you've changed. Is the first time I'd ever told the truth. It's the first time I'd ever stopped living a lie. I told my truth as I understood it. Shaky writing, lack of insight, all that stuff, but it was the best, most truth I could tell about myself, and it was transformational. Another time, the first time I went to the men's workshop at Rock Eagle, I went and actually stood with a guy who I'd been in treatment with, who was the only one who really didn't hate me, because he went to the same number of meetings I did. We called him MF and Charlie because every other word out of his mouth was that, but he's a really good guy. We stood and hold hands and said the third step prayer out loud. This hard-ass street guy, me, this quivering, you know, crazy intellectual blob, said the third step prayer and I was transformed. Those are the kinds of things that tell me about the power of the steps, but the steps aren't the set of empty actions we do on our own. What they were doing were beginning to connect me to a power greater than myself, this functional agnostic my whole life. I was never an atheist. I didn't get that involved to say, I don't believe in God. I just said, I don't believe I have any contact with God or God has anything to do with me because I was living down in my bunker. The sixth and seventh step were very interesting for me. I got lost. It was kind of like getting lost in the wilderness because, like a lot of us, maybe I thought six and seven was kind of the program's self-improvement plan, where armed with all this good fifth step knowledge, I went inside, looked at myself, made changes in how I did stuff, learned some new skills, and became a better person. My sponsor let me do that because he had a very similar experience, and also he knew I was going to a lot of meetings, and I probably wasn't in danger of getting drunk doing that. I was probably just not going to be very successful. Till finally, what really did it for me was in the midst of that self-improvement program, one time I used one of my favorite forms of humor, which isn't a form of humor at all, sarcasm. I was a you know, self-appointed king of sarcasm, and said something sarcastic, not even very heated sarcasm, just kind of mild, shrug it off kind of stuff, and saw the pain in a friend's eyes who I'd said that to. And it was another one of those moments when I saw, and that's when I began to get a glimmer. I can't fix myself. If I could fix myself, I probably would have come in here just for a tune-up and then read some self-help books and gone out and done my own higher power and not drank again, or even learn to drink successfully. But I can't do any of those things. I don't have that power. So that's the one I began working on, and my understanding of step six was stop doing the bad behavior and become willing to let go of it, and seven was replace it with something else in God's time. So for about 6 months, I didn't have a whole lot to say to anybody because I did that old thing, before you say anything, ask, is it true, is it necessary, and is it kind? And if it passes all three, then say it. And I was curiously silent for about 6 months. And people were saying, are you okay? I think I might be, you know. but I began to learn some other ways. Eight and nine, very interesting. Eight, kind of a little throwaway. So, yeah, just copy the list from four, say a prayer, yeah, I'm willing. Eight is where I really got to look at how unforgiving, closed-minded, and hard-hearted I've been my whole life. You do something to me, I may say, okay, I forgive you. I didn't really forgive you. I never forgot it. It was like you had mortally wounded me. And sometimes I wasn't even doing something to me. It was not doing enough good stuff for me or keeping up the good stuff. I would see that as a betrayal or an abandonment. Oh my God, it's like the first time I did a four step and you know, I was struggling with it, and I said, well, just start writing down the resentments. 1, 2, 3, 10, 15, 200, 400. It was like a floodgate open. The same thing with my hard heartedness. And I had to go back to six and seven a little bit to regroup and have my sponsor tell me, you know, these are character defects, but you're very average here. You know, you're just stick with it. Just stick with it. So I began doing my nine-step amends and ran into the usual barriers that we do. I wanted total forgiveness and understanding from everybody. I didn't always get that, though I got a lot of it. The second time I did my amends to my father, which were really the deepest ones, I'd hurt him so deeply without meaning to. I mean, I was just protecting my drinking, right? I didn't mean to lie to the man who would do anything for me and did do almost anything for me. We were walking around the top of Stone Mountain on a spring day. He used to come down in March, which is my anniversary date, and he used to come see me pick up a chip. And I made a fuller, more honest amends, and it was simpler, and he just stopped and looked at me and hugged me and cried some tears of joy, and our relationship was transformed. And you know, if it can happen with somebody that you've lied to like that, that you've betrayed like that, I think it can happen to anybody. Step 10, at first, as it should have been, every time I looked, I was doing something wrong, making the same mistakes or new variations on old themes of the same mistakes. You work the steps long enough, and you'll look at 10, and you'll say, wait a minute, I just did something kind, and I didn't have to, and nobody even saw it. Wait a minute, I just didn't say something witty, charming, and clever so I could advance myself at the expense of the meeting. I was quiet there, and it was good. I began to find some good things in there, and I was very suspicious of those, so I would check them out with people who say, yeah, that sounds reasonable. I think you're getting better. I was like, oh, I'm getting better, oh my God. 11 has been very interesting recently. Very recently, I've decided to really personalize 11, and it had never been totally performant, but, you know, we say prayers, and sometimes we say them a little bit, you know, by rote, and other times, particularly in times of crisis, maybe a little bit more heartfelt. I just decided to start saying them every morning, and saying them slow, and kind of savoring them, and really letting go of the outcomes, really just bringing up subjects and saying, inviting God into all those things, and just letting almost like free association examples pop up as they will. And I've been doing this about 4 or 5 months, and I have to say that my relationship with God is becoming more real, more functional, more conversational, yet at the same time, I'm seeing more power in God and a God-centered way of living than ever. So it's becoming more workaday and more part of me, and at the same time, bigger and better. So it's not like I have to go off and put the big book in the little, you know, iconic airtight container and worship. It's live it. It's just try and live it and take some time, preferably in the morning, a couple mornings I've missed and had to do it later, just set the table for the day for that. Just do that, and I've been doing that. Step 12. God, there's so many ways to do step 12. I did organized service work a lot. Of course, Captain Recovery is going to do organized service. You know, I was seeing it making frequently. Terrified to go to the mic, but I did it anyway, and it sounded like a sheep on helium. And well, I make a motion that, you know, for every creak of the nails of the podium. But I hung in there and did it. But now it's more like active listening in meetings, which I don't always do. Sometimes I do a witty aside to somebody. But sharing or leading discussions or telling my story when asked without going out and seeking out that stuff, but being fully available. Sponsoring. I love sponsoring. I love being sponsored. I have a sponsor and I sponsor. Really listening and celebrating others' recovery while freely sharing mine, but really offering when asked. You know, carry the message at all times. Use words only when necessary, when asked, that kind of thing. And really trying to listen to the music underneath other people's words without forgetting my responsibilities to myself. I totally disagree with the statement that this is a selfish program. That paragraph, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of all our problems, I totally believe that. The answer to that paragraph is not enlightened selfishness, but self-responsibility, things, me doing the things that I need to do is absolutely part of this program, but none of it has ever been at anybody else's expense. Trying to increase honesty and humility, and there's that thing, as soon as I've said it, of course, I lost a bunch of it. Yeah. But I really try and cultivate those two qualities. And then really trying to live by the traditions. That was part of the 12th step. I actually try and practice the traditions at work and at home, preferably without announcing it to people like my wife. That's an outside issue. Tradition 10 says I don't have an opinion on that because that's taking us away from Tradition 5, our primary purpose, which is to be, you know, if I do that, that's not so good. And then I want to finish by reading one thing that's become the most important passage in the literature to me right now. And this is the guy who has 100 top 5 songs. So this is my current favorite. This is from page 124 and 125 in the 12 and 12 on step 12. Right near the end of the 12 steps. Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be specially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home or in the world outside we are partners in a common effort, the well understood fact that in God's sight all human beings are important, the proof that love freely given surely brings a full return, the certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons, the surety that we need no longer be square pegs and round holes, but can fit in and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. This is my sentence. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. That's really what I was looking for my whole life. I hope you heard that in my story in fits and starts. Thank you for listening. I hope you heard something useful tonight that you can identify with, and I hope you are truly honoring and enjoying your sobriety. Thank you.
Paul, thank you for being an active partner in our common effort. That was a great story. Thank you very much. And we'll hold on to this for you. So in the seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Declining outside contributions, your donations support this group and AA its own. And I've asked Richard to give out the chips.
I'm Richard and I'm an alcoholic. A sheaf of helium, huh? I like that. Okay, we have chips that measure our progress in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a white chip for anybody that would like to quit drinking for one day at a time. And anybody that's had enough, want to try for one day. That's all it takes. After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody like to have one of these? Okay. After 3 months, we have a red chip. Anybody want one of these? Boy, you guys are good. So 6 months, a yellow chip. 9 months, a green chip. Anybody have a year or bunches of years in AA?
Hey, everybody, I'm Ron Pop, and I, like I say, I most definitely am an alcoholic. And this is number two. And Paul, you've done a lot for me, brother. You really have. You know, I don't know if you know it or not, but you have. You know, I see a lot of people out here that I know, you know, and hell, every one of you's helped a little bit, you know, if not a lot. But you know, I can't. I mean, you know, for one thing, I'm getting too old for that living under the bridge shit. Okay, because that's right where I end up. You know, I end up, I lose everything, and then you know, I'm. But what I'm doing is I keep putting one foot in front of the other. Sometimes there's a big pile of horse hockey there in the way, but I have to kick it out of the way, you know. But I knock it out of the way, and I keep putting one foot in front of the other. And, you know, I do know that I can do it. All I have to do is, you know, there's just 12... that's the way of life right there. And that's the way I'm trying. I don't always do real good, but this is the way I'm trying to live my life now. Thanks a lot, y'all.
Everybody else see the blue chip tonight?
Great. Great. Nice.
Congratulations, Ron. Okay, it's time for announcements. Any AA-related announcements? Yes, sir.
My name is Mark.
Hi, Mark.
I have a teacher literature cabinet. If anyone like an AA literature, so you ask me.
Will do. See, we got through Thanksgiving, so that's over with. And well, I'm just going to go into next week. Jack M. will be telling his story.
Yeah.
All right. Smile like that. He's going to tell us the secret of his happiness. And on the 14th? Yes? Okay, Monica D. 24 years last October, right?
Wow.
Okay, well, if there's nothing else, I'd like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Okay, Angela is going to take us out.
Who gave us the rivers and cleaned out our livers? Our Father, who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, for power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep on that with the works that you are yet to
do. Oh, yes.
John Hanks.